وهينو عمدو نايلو هينو علينو ما سيدنو كنو نايلو ما سيدنو كنو نيهم. Shalom Aleichem, Baruchim Abayim, welcome everyone. We are in the middle of our Shiurim, our lessons in the prophecies of Isaiah. We are now in what might be one of the most famous sections of the entire book. We are going to be focusing on the chapter 53, which in the original Hebrew actually begins in the 52nd chapter from the 13th verse. And this is a discussion of the famous suffering servant of God. God's famous servant. Now, before we can even go through this line by line, let's put this chapter in its historical and theological context. For those who are familiar with the religious relationship between Judaism and Christianity, this chapter has been a bone of contention between the two, literally, since the inception of Christianity. The suffering servant, the one who is maligned, beaten, chastised, and who atones for the sins of others, etc., has since the beginnings of Christianity been embraced as references to Yeshu. Now, how this is applied to Yeshu, in my opinion, is the fundamental interesting point. Because this contention here about Isaiah has to be understood again within the greater context of the book of Isaiah, as we've been discussing in all of our previous lessons in this series, the nature and method of traditional Semitic poetry, also prophetic soliloquy. Remember how I described in our previous lessons how a prophet came about to have these words written, that he's kind of like in a meditative trance and he's just like rambling as God is speaking through him. His mind is experiencing images, ideas, concepts, and he may or may not even be aware of the words that he is speaking as his prophetic students are sitting there writing them down. Obviously, that is how these words were also recorded. We have no evidence to suggest, nothing to make us believe that the placement of this here is in any way arbitrary or artificial, and that it is obviously not a continuation of flow of that which came before it, and obviously connected to that which comes after it. And in that respect, we must understand the nature, concept of this material within the greater context of Isaiah. So then, when the verse here says, again, 52:13, indeed, or behold, my servant will prosper, and we ask the immediate question, well, who is the servant? Clearly, Isaiah has identified the concept of God's servant as being the Jewish people, the nation of Israel. This is clearly stated in chapter 49, in the third verse, where it says, you are my servant Israel, in whom I will glory, which is clearly reflected back here in this. It is also referenced in earlier chapters, where Israel is again referred to as God's servant over and over. Historically, therefore, Isaiah, if he's referring to a servant, most likely didn't change which servant he's talking about and should be consistent as he has already identified the matter. Now, this is where the contention has come. But this contention between Christianity and Judaism, which is the fundamentals of Isaiah 53, in my opinion, is almost artificial. There are the traditional classic Jewish commentators based upon the overall view of Isaiah, who will say the servant spoken of here is clearly the Jewish people and the sufferings of the Jewish people throughout history. When we go through the chapter verse by verse, we'll detail this. And then again, you have a good number of Jewish commentators, classical traditional commentators, who, like their Christian counterparts, or I should say Christian antagonists, that's the word used to describe them by the classical Jewish biblical commentator Rashi, He calls them Palugotenal, our classical antagonists. Jewish classical writers will say this also refers to the Messiah, to which Christians would jump and say, aha, the Jews admit it, that it's referring to the Messiah, and thus it must be a reference to Yeshu. To which I have to respond and say, let's stay a little bit more detached from a fundamentalist and or, you know, emotional point of view, and let's look at this from a scholarly point of view. Because one thing, as I researched this material, I found really interesting. Absolutely every single Jewish mention of this chapter applying to Mashiach, the Messiah, comes in a period of history much later than the original Christian references to this being related to Yeshu. In other words, if you go into the classical fundamental origins of how Isaiah was always understood, it was always understood as a reference to the Jewish people, and only years, centuries later, after the Christians, did any Jewish person ever apply it to an individual who we can call the Messiah. Now you could say, well, what does that mean? And it's a great question. And in order to understand that, I think that we have to understand all Jewish biblical commentary, and I might add, to include the original writers of the Jewish literature, which was the foundation of Christianity. Remember, please, this is so essential from a historical, scholarly point of view. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, especially the Jewish authors, James, Peter, John, Matthew, all of these guys were Jews. None of them were Christians. They had never in their lives said the Nicene Creed. They never said the Apostolic Creed ever. It is, I believe, can be argued that they never believed in virgin births or resurrections or anything of the kind, because these individuals who were the original Jewish followers of Yeshu were not Christian. They were actually members of, by their own definition, the Nazarite order of Jerusalem, also referred to as the Ebionites. Both orders, the Nazareans and the Ebionites, were actually excommunicated and rejected by later Christendom, and their ideas considered heretical. Their original ideas, considered heretical by the church, were the Jewish ideas of the original founders of the church. How interesting that later theologians came into the church, non-Jewish in origin, integrating and pagan non-Jewish concepts, ideas, and theologies, possibly based upon the writings of Paul, or possibly embellished or other interpretations of Paul. Just as a side note, when I, as an Orthodox rabbi, come and read the Jewish writings, Paul was a Jew. When he writes in, for example, the book of Romans, the Christian book of Romans, this concept of this dichotomy, this argument, are we saved by law or grace? This is not a Christian theological discussion, in spite of however anyone in the entire history of the church might imagine. This type of discussion occurred in Talmudic circles centuries before Paul even mentioned it. He is making a classical Talmudic discussion an idea. Where is our blessing before God? The concept that James brings up, faith without works is dead, etc., and so on, is also Jewish. All of these ideas and concepts I recognize as a rabbi, because Paul, or for that matter James, or for that matter Matthew, even for that matter John, were all trained in traditional, classical Jewish teachings of the day. And you can challenge it, how do you know that? And the answer is really very logical. Because there was nothing else. There was no Christendom then. There was no church. There was no anything else. You might refer to ascetic teachings or Pharisaic teachings, but these are just kind of words of describing groups which, whose differences might not have been as radical as many people today believe. The concepts, ideas of such groups like the Essenes and the Pharisees, when we look at it historically, from a Kabbalistic and Talmudic points of view, the two groups become very much blurred, and the distinction between them apparently might just be in areas of fine applications of Jewish law as opposed to anything theologically or philosophically. I mean, they all like dressed the same, acted the same. You had good guys and bad guys amongst them. And in this respect, when we're coming to understand all of the Bible, especially something as apparently controversial, because it really shouldn't be controversial, so I say apparently, as Isaiah 53. When the original Jewish authors are making a reference to Isaiah in reference to Yeshu, what do they mean? What is their intent? And the obvious answer to this is within the context of classical Jewish biblical interpretation, the likes of which we have seen in previous lessons in this Isaiah series. When Matthew wants to state that Yeshu is somehow a fulfillment of a prophecy written in Isaiah 7:14 about the young woman giving birth to a famous child or a child of a sign, he wasn't making a reference to anything of a virgin birth. There wasn't such a concept in Judaism at the time. And Matthew, being a Jew knowing Hebrew, would know that the Hebrew word alma did not mean betula. And the application, therefore, of the virgin birth concept clearly came from non-Jewish sources. This is documented historically. And Matthew's intent of applying this verse was not necessarily a literal fulfillment of a prophecy, but rather what we call a midrash. A metaphorical, symbolic, embellished application to taking a verse not so much out of context, but taking a verse and applying it moralistically as opposed to literally. And this is how Midrash always works, wherein which we would take a simple verse of the Bible. And I said, this is what it literally means. Well, no, it's just being applied to teach us a moral point. Matthew, John, James, Peter, Paul, and I'm going to say Mark and Luke, probably under their influences, most likely applied and wrote about our Torah and our Tanakh within that context. Simply because at the time there really was no other context. And that is the mentality that we must take in understanding how the verses in Isaiah 53 were also used by the original Jewish authors to apply to Yeshu. They clearly knew that Isaiah wrote in chapter 49 that the servant is Israel, and it spoke of the history of the entire Jewish people. Therefore, what were they saying? Isaiah was wrong? That only they understood the Bible better than Isaiah himself? Of course not. They were thinking in this context of what we call Midrash. And therefore, it's interesting that when you discuss the story and history of Yeshu, and look at it in light of this chapter, I think this chapter does more to prove that it does not speak of Yeshu, the historical person, that it could ever be applied to say that it does refer to him. There are so many specific details. And even though the church wishes to make reference of a first and second coming to make fulfillment of this and that thing, there are still specific verses in this chapter which, in my opinion, categorically discount it to ever being applied historically to Yeshua. And at the same time, that would not discount the Jewish writers quoting specific verses to apply to Yeshua, simply because they recognize that this is not an issue of a literal historical fulfillment of prophecy, but again, this more metaphorical, moralistic application. And when we recognize it like this, then we really don't have to have a major conflict of opinions of what Isaiah really means. Historically, and from a scholarly point of view, I believe the meaning of the chapter is relevant and clear from the greater context of Isaiah, as we shall discuss when we get into it. But yet the other applications, whether they be Christian or later Jewish, are all following this metaphorical concept of midrashic application. And in my opinion, that's just fine. In all due respect, unless we have to respond to attacking missionaries who in their fundamentalist zeal are endeavoring to create division and cause strife by enforcing their views, by stating it is this and not that, you're wrong and you have to believe us or else, unless we have to respond to that type of fundamentalist foolishness, then this really should not be a bone of contention between religions. If people wish to say, well, I believe that it refers to this, believe whatever you want. And if the others say, I want to say that it refers to that, believe whatever you want. Only when we have to, literally, when we are attacked, must we defend. But we should never be the likes to go on the attack, to try to change the beliefs of others. Nowhere does God command us, in my opinion, to be iconoclastic, meaning to challenge the cherished beliefs of others. If we are pursuers of truth, then we will investigate from a scholarly point of view what truth is. And knowing truth, we can then ask that fundamental question, why do people believe otherwise? And we can take the course through history to answer that, like this introduction, as I've tried to do. And then walk away from it, at least understanding where people are at. And recognizing that based upon emotional considerations, people choose their course of faith. These will believe this, and those will believe that. And frankly, for me, it's never been a matter of what your beliefs are. I'm always concerned about what your behavior and actions are. Like James said, if I, as an Orthodox rabbi, can quote an old Jew who is now embraced as a Christian, faith without works is dead. I want to know what you're doing. That, to me, is the most important thing, rather than to stick on the bone of contention. With this introduction, with this concept, let's go through the verses one by one, read them as we have in our past, and see the curious nature of this material. In my translation that I have before me, it says, indeed, my servant will prosper. He will be raised, lifted up, greatly exalted. Again, who is the servant? All right? Go back to Isaiah 49. Chapter verse 3, you are my servant Israel, in whom I will glory, in whom I will be exalted. Well, kind of like, there you go. It's referenced here very clearly that the Jewish people is the metaphorical servant. There's references to that in earlier chapters in Isaiah as well. But now, this servant is spoken of in such a peculiar way. Just as many people were appalled at him, it says here. His appearance was so disfigured. His form was like inferior to a human. So will he shake up many nations, and kings will hold their tongues because of him. For they have seen things they were never told, and beheld that which they had not heard. Now, what is this? They're appalled at him. Ah, reference to Yeshua. Not necessarily. Let's not jump so quick. Appearance was disfigured. Ah, just like he was beaten before the cross. Again, let's not jump so quickly. All right? He will shake up many nations. Ah, second coming, they say, and all the rest. All right, just let's relax. Take it easy now, all right? I know people of faith are going to jump upon words, but we have to look at words from a context of their historical accuracy. Isaiah is speaking of the servant. The servant he has clearly identified previously as Israel, the Jewish people. So before a Christian wants to jump on the Yeshu bandwagon, I will ask them, please, let's just take a moment. Let's look at it from the other side. How could this possibly be a reference to the Jewish people and to Israel? Only a closed-minded fundamentalist who is not open to truth would ever say, well, it can't be, and therefore it can't be, and therefore it is not, and therefore it's only Yeshu, and you got to believe it, you go to hell. I can't talk to people of that mentality simply because there is no dialogue. There's only a monologue. But for those who do want to listen, I ask you, my Orthodox Jewish brethren, myself, I ask those who would interpret this regarding Yeshu, let's put it on the other coin. We know how you understand it as referring to Christendom. Try to understand it as we do as Jews. Just try. What would therefore be the meaning when we say just as many people were appalled at him? Now, don't be concerned about the application of the singular tense here. Because the servant is singular, just as it was in Isaiah 49, what is clearly identified as my servant Israel. Okay? So the context of it being singular or plural is not an issue. But let's read this as it refers to Israel. Just as many people were appalled at Israel, him, Israel's appearance was so disfigured, and Israel's form inferior to a man's. All right? And so Israel will shake up many nations, and kings will hold their tongues because of Israel. For they have seen things they were never told, and beheld what they had not heard. That's how we can read it as it refers to Israel. But what now does that mean? As we get into the rest of Isaiah 53, and interpret it in this light, we will see that the Jewish people are referred to as God's suffering servant. But now, this is interesting because we have to look at the concept and role of Israel as we have throughout all the prophecies we've read previous. Israel is supposed to be a light to the nations. They are scattered throughout the lands by God as a punishment for their sins, and yet God's promises have been with the Israelite nation for restoration, bringing back to the land, being brought on the shoulders of kings and the like. Apparently, the soliloquy of the prophet, which is, I said, continuous in the context of what we've read in the past, is now describing where Israel is in the interim, from the time of the punishment and exile until the time of the promised redemption. Well, where are they? They are here in this middle. They are out in the nations, scattered, viewed as unliked, scorned, as the words here, disfigured, less than a man. And where is the first reference that we have to this? In the Babylonian exile itself, in the story of the biblical book of Esther, where in which Haman refers to the Jewish people as this strange people. Don't follow the king's laws. He's already prejudiced against them. In essence, fulfillment of these words here spoken in Isaiah. So this concept of the Jews suffering, and if you know the biblical story, the book of Esther, which gave rise to the holiday of Purim, how the Jews were literally all sold to be murdered, executed, everything stolen. If that's not suffering, I don't know what is. Haman was like the first Hitler who tried to kill all the Jews. Indeed, this could only have been accomplished in ancient Persia because of the complicity of the national consensus of the people. They must not have liked the Jews. You do not point to a beloved minority which everybody embraces and loves and likes And all of a sudden you want to kill, because no one would tolerate it. No one would accept it. And therefore, the concept is clearly understood that even in those days, the exiled Jews were considered disfigured as such. But yet in the end, it says they will shake up many nations, the kings will hold their tongues. Look what happened to the Jews in Purim. Somehow, in some way, a miracle occurred. Even though the name of God is not mentioned in the book at all, as we know. And the Jews were saved. They rose up to the heights. Their enemies were defeated, and Ahasuerus, amongst others, would have held their tongues. Said, good gosh, look what happened. For they had seen things they were never told, that the Jews would rise up and behold that which they had not heard. Who would know? And just like Isaiah 53, who can believe what we heard? Upon whom God's arm is revealed. Now, we spoke about God's arm in our previous lessons. It's not the hand of God, the arm, the source of the power, which is still concealed. And this is such an application to the Purim story, wherein which the Jews in ancient Persia were saved by, if you will, a curious course of coincidental events. This is why the name of God is not written in the book of Esther at all, anywhere. Because it was God's arm that acted, not God's hand. The concealed power of God was revealed. How? By allowing the course of events to shift and turn the fate of the Jewish people, who indeed suffered in ancient Persia under the hands of Haman. And this has been, if you will, A, the reason why the book of Esther was recorded in the Bible, B, to serve as a role model and an example for all Jews during this time of exile. That this has exactly been the history of the Jewish people. Even though Jews have suffered under the hands of ancient Persians, ancient Greeks, ancient Romans, ancient Byzantiums, Christians, Muslims, and the like, thousands of years of persecution, similar types of experiences was in ancient Persia under the days of Haman and Ahasuerus. And here we are to this day, thousands of years later, alive, strong. It's interesting that back in the 1800s, I believe someone once asked the famous American author Mark Twain for proof of the existence of God, and he said, look at the Jews. There's your proof right there, that somehow, in some way, we have survived. So now, who can believe what we have heard? How is this even possible? The arm of God revealed. He grew up like a young plant. And again, it says here in the singular, and I admit that, but as we've learned from previously in Isaiah, this reference to the singular has always been applied to collected Israel. The prophet is seeing an image in his mind, possibly of an individual. And that individual is, if you will, a representation of collective Israel. This kind of image of an individual representing a collective is not unique to Judaism. We find it in the Christian reference as well. I can reference you all to the Christian book of Revelations, written by the Jew, John, who was having a mystical, meditative, visual experience, similar to all Jews before him. And in the later chapters, he sees this great woman, and he says, this is Babylon. Babylon is obviously a nation. But he sees it in the image of an individual and refers to the nation as she, in similar way as Isaiah is referring here to the nation of Israel as he. Again, scholarly speaking, we must be honest in how the Semitic mindset wrote their poetic literature. And we can't get stuck up in grammar here and taking things outside of context, because that's not being honest. And I will quote a Christian statement here. You will know the truth, and the truth will set you free. John 14:6, right? Christians all know that. But if we're talking about truth and freedom, freedom is freedom of intellect, freedom of mind, freedom to know what the scholarly true understanding of the text is. So please, let's not get caught up in the singular. Grew up like a young plant, like a root in dry ground. Right? No form, beauty that we should look at him, and no appearance that we should desire him. In application to the Jewish people from the days of Persia, they were this minority, having all these strange types of customs, weird looks. You see the same type of ideas in application today. When people think of, for example, the Hasidic Jews in areas like Israel or New York, in their strange antiquated costumes, their long side locks and strange, people look at this as some type of an example for a National Geographic cultural icon special. I've even seen National Geographic magazine having a special on the Hasidic Jews of Brooklyn and looking at them as some unique, strange ethnic group, like some lost, forgotten tribe in Africa or in the Amazon. How strange, how weird, how bizarre. They're not like us. They are this strange people. Nothing that we would like. Despised, as it says here. A person who people would avoid. And look at the way people today, in all communities, look at religious Jews. They're not the people you tend to associate with. They're not your friends. I ask any non-Jew listening, how many of you ever would invite an Orthodox Jew to your home to be your friend? How many of them would accept? How many of them would you feel comfortable with? Now, I know the specific people listening to this recording right now, okay, you guys might be an exception. But I emphasize exception as opposed to the rule. Religious Jews are usually ostracized, not only by their secular Jewish counterparts, but all the more so by the general non-Jewish world at large. Their existence clearly fulfills the definition of these words here. Despised, as we said, a person of suffering, knowing illness. All right? People turn their eyes away from him. The religious Jew has always been accused of being the source of all the world's problems. Right now we are, at the time of this recording, October 2008, a time of economic instability in the world. And if anyone were to go on to the computer and look at all the blog sites of all of the talk about what is causing this economic crisis, and of course everybody is blaming the Jews. Again, the Jews are the scapegoat. The Jews are the cause. People turn their eyes always away from the Jews. This is the nature of the Jewish illness. Not that you have a cold, not that you have a virus, not that you have a runny nose or a stuffed head, but the illness of human prejudice. He was despised and we held him of no account. Yet he bore our sickness and suffered our pains. We considered him afflicted, smitten by God, tortured. Two things here. Despised and we held him of no account. Clearly a reference to the faithful of the Jewish people, who are, in essence, to this very day, in this very moment, despised, disrespected, disliked by the general world at large. The religious Jewish community, for example, in Israel, national religious Zionists speak of the greatness of the land of Israel, the wanting and the desire to rebuild the Holy Temple, to have pride and honor in the Jewish identity. They are considered, even in Israel amongst the secular, a pariah. They are hated. They are despised by the world. They are considered Jewish extremists because of their faithfulness to Torah. If and when religious Jews today speak up of the biblical standards for morality, they are condemned for speaking hate. This is the despising. This is the illness. This is the sickness. We are rejected. We are despised. This is the clear context of how Isaiah is speaking of the Jewish people. And how do the Jewish people respond? Do we rebel? Do we retaliate? Do we react with acts of violence and terrorism and say, you must accept our way? No. Bore our sicknesses, suffered our pains. The Jewish people have always been known to be rather passive to things. Whether it was in the submissiveness of aspects like the terrible Holocaust perpetuated by the Germans in World War II, or in countless previous Holocausts perpetuated by the Christians during the pogroms, the Christians in the Inquisition, or in the earlier times. I'm stumbling over words here, thinking of two and three different examples to give all at once, but there are just so many. And similar things like this has happened also in the Islamic world, though not as many. And Jewish people have never acted with retaliatory violence, never acted other than to move on, grin and bear it. How does God look at this? We considered him afflicted, smitten by God, tortured. If you look into Christian theology, the Christian theology states because the Jewish people have rejected Yeshua as their Messiah, therefore rejected the authority of the church, they are to be afflicted. They are supposed to be smitten by God and tortured because that's their due. Now, that is how the church would look at things. To this very day, I do believe that is mostly Christian theology. I consider that to be unfortunate. I consider it to be a rather warped that you would have such a theology of racism and prejudice against the groups just because they don't accept your theology. But unfortunately, it is the reality. We continue here. Verse 5, he was wounded because of our sins and crushed by our transgressions. Here again, the Christians say, wounded by our sins, the crucifixion, and obviously reference to Yeshua. But again, I say, let's look at it within the context of how we've been going on here. The Jewish people have definitely suffered. All right? The word here, wounded, can also be interpreted as being slain or shaken up. A clear reference to the sufferings, the prejudice, the violence that the Jewish people have suffered under Christian and other non-Jewish hands, simply because of who and what we are remaining faithful to the levels of morality that we are supposed to embrace, and the faithfulness of that which we represent, crushed by our transgressions. Who is the our here? Is Isaiah necessarily speaking now about the Jewish people? Apparently, within the context of this chapter, he is channeling, if you will, the general voice of the nations of the world. His prophetic soliloquy here is not speaking as a Jew about Israel, because that's obviously the servant of whom he speaks. But if you will, he is tapped into the collective consciousness of the nations. And speaking, we, meaning the nations, are the ones who look to Israel with such despising. And we are the ones who crush them, beat them down, because of our transgressions. What on earth would motivate one group of people to so hate another because of theology, to want to subject him to the worst cases of abuse, suffering, pain, and torture? That, it's, to me, is inconceivable. What kind of twistedness in evil exists within their souls that you would want to do that to another human being? I, for example, do not agree with the theology of a Christian, Muslim, Hindu, Buddhist, or go list 100 other. I have my own theology. But God forbid would I ever wish to inflict upon other human beings pain and suffering, tortures and hardship simply because we disagree on a theological issue. I find this is inconceivable. But yet, those others do exactly that to us. We suffer because of their transgressions. We are wounded because of their sins. The twistedness, the perversions, the evil in their hearts and their minds. My God, what on earth is wrong here? Don't tell me, well, this is what they've been taught. You can teach me until I'm blue in the face. These people are evil. These people are bad. These people are whatever. And I'll say, oh, maybe they are. But you want to know something? God will deal with it. Let me give you an example. Here I am sitting as an Orthodox Jew in a world in which radical Islam wants to literally rise up and wipe out the nation of Israel, and some will say all the Jewish people. I understand. I understand the enemy that faces me. And if God forbid I am attacked, of course I would fight back. But as a human being, as one who wishes to embrace the Torah, I would never say, let's go wipe out and kill all the Arabs. God forbid. Let's go wipe out and destroy Islam. God forbid. This is not the Torah way. This is not the human way. We'll disagree. Theology, fine. I will have to fight if I am attacked. I understand that too. I only wish I wasn't attacked. I only wish that there wasn't such hatred presented here. But the fact that such hatred exists, the fact that some people could be motivated to attack, in all due respect, please don't point a finger at modern day Arabs. You have to go look into history. Christians have done this for thousands of years before the Arabs ever got the idea in their head. Hundreds of years before Muhammad was even born, Christians have been having their holy wars. This is the way it's been. This, to me, is terrible. This is, to me, why we suffer. And when I say we, I'm referring to all of those of us who are, you'll allow me to use the word, enlightened human beings, who suffer at the hands of those who are fundamentalists, who are so liable to be motivated by their emotions, to act inhumanely towards fellow human beings, which I might add is a comprehensive contradiction to everything the message of Yeshu came to taught. Just as a side note, quoting the Christian Bible, Matthew 25, in which there is a story told that on the day of judgment, the son, the lamb, whatever it states there, is going to judge the peoples. And they all come before him. And he separates them to the right and to the left. And he says to the ones on the right, blessed are you. And they ask, well, why? What did we do? He says, when I was hungry, you fed me, thirsty, gave me drink. When I was naked, you clothed me. And they scratch their heads and go, well, when did we ever do this to you? He says, whenever you did this to the littlest of my people, it's as if you did it to me. Who were my people? Well, this is Yeshu talking, as the Midrashic story here in Matthew wants to say. Obviously, we're talking about the Jews. There were no other people for him to have at the time. Those are his people. Cursed are you, he said to the ones on the left. Why? I was hungry, didn't feed me. Thirsty, didn't give me drink. I was naked, you didn't clothe me. When did we do this to you? Whenever you didn't do it to the least of my people. Here, the value of judgment is not based upon your theology or your faith, but specifically on how you treated the Jewish people. Whether you sinned against them and crushed them or not. This is what Yeshu himself taught. He, meaning again the Jewish people, was punished so that we should enjoy well-being, and we were healed by his wounds. This is the psychology of scapegoatism. Think about it. Today, when we have an economic crisis, who do the people blame? Themselves because of their own greed? Because of their own instability? No, it's the fault of the Jews. The Jews did it. Let's go get the Jews. And everybody speaks like that. Everybody does that. God forbid it leads to violence and terror. And ultimately, then people feel better about themselves that they have exercised the evil amongst them. And this is how they feel better. They literally project their own evil and bad outside themselves and upon the Jews. And by getting the Jews, they thus feel better about themselves. This is traditional psychological projection and transference, scapegoatism. It's a psychology of how people literally endeavor to cleanse their own inner demons by literally making believe that they are inside others rather than inside themselves. This is how they are, if you will, healed. This is not just a magical aspect of vicarious suffering of the righteous for the sake of the wicked. even that has to be understood psychologically within the context of its actual application. And now Isaiah is continuing to speak as if for the nations. We all strayed like sheep, and each of us went his own way. Again, we strayed like sheep, and then each of us went his own way again. He refers back and forth from the collective to the individual in the grammatical sense, so we have to understand that within its metaphorical context. But God laid all of our sins on him. This is part of the divine plan. This is how Israel is a light to the nations. Specifically, by being there, being a light, not a violent reaction to those who are so psychologically infantile and immature that they don't know how to deal with their own issues. It's kind of like if you look at a child. When in which the child does something wrong or incorrect, the parent comes and corrects them. The child might throw a temper tantrum. Oh, how come you're picking on me? It's not like this, it's not like that. What does the parent do? Beat the child and say, how dare you talk to me? What do you know? The parent grins and bears it and knows that the child will eventually grow up and overcome their temper tantrum. And the parent takes it in silence as the young, immature child throws the tantrum because the young child, parent knows, doesn't know any better. In the collective of humanity, all of us are in a psychological growth pattern. And all of human history is the ultimate growing up of mankind, of humanity. And the coming of Mashiach will be childhood's end. And this is what we look forward to. But right now, in this time period, this is what we're going through. This is what it says, he laid all his sins on him. God allows the Jewish people to suffer in this way because, like the spiritual parent, this is the way the nations learn. And ultimately, if you look in the course of history, the fundamentals of what Judaism and Torah have stood for have now spread to the four corners of the earth. Islam has embraced it. Christianity has embraced it. Granted, they embrace other things as well. But everyone in all corners of the world now know of our Bible, our Torah, the Ten Commandments, or what we call the seven universal fundamentals of general spirituality. In Hebrew we call them the Sheva Mitzvot of Bnei Noach. And in spite of those today who want to take those and create their own fundamentalist, almost religion around them, the universal concepts are clearly accepted, almost, if you will, by everyone. That is a radical change to how things were in the days when Isaiah wrote these words. So God's plan for mankind is progressive, is succeeding, is moving right along. He was afflicted, but he submitted without opening his mouth. Jewish people surrendering at the hands of those who would be prejudiced against them, tell lies about them, how we're always in charge of the world and everything else. Oh, please. You don't see Jews yelling and screaming and blowing up bombs and going after people for saying such things. How dare you desecrate the Torah? All right? Hashem Elohim, we're going to blow you up. You don't hear Jews talking like that. Let's have a jihad to save the Holy Land. You don't hear Jews talking like that either. It's not our way. That's not the way Hashem has commanded us to be. He was led to the slaughter like a lamb. Aha! Reference to Yeshu. Oh, really? Maybe it's a reference to the Jews who died in the Holocaust, or who died at the hands of the Inquisitors, or who died at the hands of the Inquisition, or the days of the Crusaders, all right? Like a sheep done before its shearers, didn't open its mouth. He was taken away without protection or justice, definitely applicable to the Jewish people who have suffered under the hands of their accusers, the people who wanted to show us persecution. Right? Trumped up charges, lies, such malicious, disgusting things. Like Jews would murder children and put their blood in the Passover matzah. Ugh, the thought of such a thing is disgusting. Jewish minds would never even fantasized, thought of such a terrible thing. Well, the more so is it morally repugnant. Obviously in violation of biblical Torah laws. But that's secondary to the fact of it's human being humanly repugnant. Who would have thought of such a thing? Obviously only a twisted mind, but these are the accusations made against Jews throughout history. I might add, to this very day. Okay? Without protection, no justice here. He was cut off from the land of the living because of the sins of my people, their transgressions, right? This is again Isaiah speaking as if the Jewish people suffering at the hands of the nations. Cut off from the land of the living. Some say, aha, that's a reference to Yeshu being executed. Well, okay, that's how you want to interpret it, right? But it makes much more sense when we look at it within the context of the Jewish people and the history of all the things that they suffered because of the closed-mindedness of people. Now, he was buried with the wicked and the wealthy, and after his death, although he had done nothing violent and spoken no falsehood. Jewish people were always buried as being wicked, right? The evil, dirty Jews, let's get rid of them. And the wealthy, aren't the Jews always referred to as the wealthy? Right? They got all the money. They're all in the banks. They're all out to get us. Let's kill them because they're wicked. Some would say that this is a reference to Yeshu. Now, Yeshu was allegedly buried, I believe, in the grave of, what was it, Nicodemus, I believe? And he was supposedly a wealthy Jew. But nowhere was he ever referred to as a wicked Jew. So therefore, how this verse could be applicable to Yeshu being buried with in that grave doesn't say that he was killed with the wicked, as maybe a reference to the Christian story of him being crucified between two alleged thieves. The word, I believe, was Sicarii, or Jewish terrorists / freedom fighters. He was buried with the wicked. That doesn't apply to Yeshu, right? And after his death, although he did nothing violent, spoken no falsehood. Interestingly, Yeshu, historically, was condemned by the rabbis specifically for his applications of violence. Think not that I've come to bring peace, I've come to bring a sword, he said. In Luke, where he says, bring my enemies before them and slaughter them at my feet. You remember the story of Peter in the Garden of Gethsemane? He had a sword. Jumps up and chops off a guy's ear. I always asked, how come a fisherman is carrying a sword? What, he chop up his fish? What's he doing with a sword? Number two, how come he's so quick to use it? That shows that he has a military or a martial experience with it. Number three, how did he get so good with it that he could chop off a guy's ears with one single shot? I challenge anybody to pick up a sword, a knife, anything. Try to do that, and you'll see it's not easy. When Yeshu's man, Simon Zealotus, one of his top disciples, is called a zealot. When Judas, another one of his people, Iscariot, for again the word Sicarii, the Sicarii, the original Aramaic word for the Iscariot, were known assassins, zealots in the days of the Second Temple. Apparently, Yeshu was surrounded by violent zealots. Two of his top disciples, Zealotus and Iscariot, carry with them the names, associating them with the specific group which instigated the civil war against Rome, leading to the murder of over 1.5 million Jews. Again, who suffered under the hands of those, their oppressors. So, Yeshu's connection here to violence is clearly documented, both historically as well as in the Christian record. So how could it be applied here, although he'd done nothing violent? Well, I don't know how that applies to him. But applying it to the Jewish people, it makes much more sense. And continuing applying this to the Jewish people, it said, but God chose to crush him and make him sick, that the Jewish people were meant to suffer because that's what it takes to be a light to the nations. That's what it is to be a parent. Parents always suffer from their children, and we all darn well know it. Our kids give us enough heartache with everything that they go through. We worry every day, oh my God, are they going to make it home alive today? And that's not when they're going out driving for the first time in high school. Gosh, we worried about this when they're in first grade. The kind of craziness that children do. The kind of craziness that they're exposed to. Nothing new under the sun. Children, old times, are facing the same things. And we parents always sit and worry. Spiritually, it's the same thing. Jewish people, however secular they may be, have always risen to the heights in such fields as medicine, the arts, and the sciences, contributing to the betterment of mankind in whichever way the society needed. That's just what's in the Jewish nature. And that is why you don't find many Jewish generals, Jewish sports figures, Jewish warriors, maybe in biblical days. But since the times of exile, when these words of Isaiah apply to the Jewish people, they are more a light to the nations rather than an arm of war. That's why you don't find many Jewish generals, maybe modern day Israel, but of course that's due to necessity, not choice. Jews have always risen to the ranks of those who have contributed to the greatness of society. Are they thanked for it? No. Loved for it? No. Appreciated for it? No. Do they still do it? Yes. Will they continue to still do it? Yes. Simply because that's the Jewish way. So, it says here, God chose to crush and make him sick, so if he realized that he was a guilt offering. Because we do what we have to do, we make the world better. That's what a guilt offering does. It shows God that in spite of however bad things are, we can still make it better. That's what a guilt offering is. Now here's the verse. Because of this, he will have offspring and enjoy long life. In my opinion, these words clearly contradict this application to being to Yeshu. Yeshu, according to the Christian tradition, died at the age of 33, a bachelor, not married, without children. Of course, the old original Nazarene and other teachings say that he was married and had kids, but Christianity doesn't want to accept that. So therefore, how can this verse, he will have offspring and enjoy long life, ever apply to Yeshu historically? I don't see how that's possible. You can not interpret that about any second coming, because nowhere does it say if and when in the Christian tradition, if allegedly Yeshu returns, that he's going to be married and have kids and enjoy a long life. You could say, well, he lives forever because he's resurrected. Okay, fine. But what about having kids? That's not a concept of enjoying a long life. It said life eternal. This is clearly a context in a different way. The Jewish people, however, have children and enjoy a long life as a nation, not necessarily as an individual, because we have survived thousands of years. When Isaiah wrote these words, the power nations in those days were the ancient Babylonians, the ancient Assyrians, the Hittites, and the Amorites were probably still around. When was the last time you met a Hittite or an Amorite? When was the last time you spoke to a Babylonian or an Assyrian? Right? Those are footnotes in ancient history. We were there, and we are here. We have the offspring. We are the offspring. We as a nation enjoy the long life. And God's cause will prosper in his and the servants' honor hands. God's cause, shining the light to the world. The light of morality, truth, righteousness. He will see the labors, he will see the blessings from his labors and be satisfied. The Jewish people have great satisfaction in knowing that we help the world be better, regardless of whether we're appreciated for it or not. Through his wisdom, my righteous servant will set many on the right path. Clearly influence of Judaism and Torah upon the world today. And he will bear their sins, just like the Jews always did. Just like if you give to a child something, he goes, gee, thanks, and then bites the hand that feeds them. What do? Parents, we grin and bear it. Judaism is the mother religion. It's the from which all comes forth. I think that's a clearly historical statement. I don't think anybody could really deny that. I can even postulate and endeavor to show historically that many of the teachings of Judaism are the foundations of the teachings of Eastern religions, possibly even Native American religions, and others all around the world, and not just the two popular of Christianity and Islam. God's promise then, I will give him a portion with many, meaning many nations, and he will receive the mighty as his spoils. Again, the promise in the future of the appropriate blessings of Israel in the future. All right? Since he exposed himself to death, the Jewish people, and was counted amongst the sinners, as the Jewish people always are, he bore the sins of many and prayed on behalf of sinners. Now, these final words, Christian will say, yeah, but that's applicable to Yeshua too. And now, I'm going to throw in a zinger to you. How we can merge all the different convergent views is one. You see, this is a point made by many of the Jewish sages. If all of these are spoken of the person of the Messiah, how can it also be spoken of as the nation of Israel? And the answer is this. In Judaism, the Messiah is still considered to be one of the nation. He is, of course, the head of the nation. As the head of the nation, the Messiah faces as an individual the destiny that the nation faces collectively. In Judaism, we've always had the concept of the suffering servants of God. We have a long history of such suffering servants in Judaism. We have the great Talmudic sages, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, before him Rabbi Akiva, murdered, sacrificed for God for the sake of righteousness. Throughout the centuries, countless great sages who were murdered, executed, tortured because of their faith in Torah and Judaism, burned at the stake, amongst others, until ultimately down to this last days in the Holocaust, and even today in modern Israel, Jews murdered because of their faith and who and what they are as people. Yes, this very well could be applied to the Messiah as an individual, but only because he is part of the nation. The nation does not follow his lead, but on the contrary, he follows the lead of the nation. The king of the nation and the nation are one. And therefore, historically speaking, this chapter clearly is speaking of the nation. As again, Isaiah has spoken before in previous verses. There is no mention here of any specific individual. And we mentioned why? Because of the metaphorical application, which we find is not exclusive to Isaiah or to Judaism. Again, quoting John and his reference to Babylon. We see this as a clear way of understanding and making poetic references to general things by referring it as a specific. And yet, those Christians who want to accept the Midrashic metaphorical application of this to their Yeshua, I guess they will. I'm not here to challenge that. But actually, I'm here to help enlighten, educate, and explain how it might not just be exclusively that, and that the Jewish way of understanding is equally valid. My Jewish listeners should know this and be able thus to answer those radical fundamentalist attacking missionaries who literally want to destroy Jews and Judaism because of their unconscious latent anti-Semitism, which is exactly the cause of the bruising causing harm to the Jewish people. In essence, those who are causing the harm to the servant here are those same fundamentalist missionaries attacking and hurting Jews. They think, oh, I'm doing it for their salvation. No, you're not. You're doing it to hurt. You're doing it because of the anti-Semitism in you, whether you like it or not, because you refuse to accept that Judaism has any validity to it and that Torah mitzvot are true. That's the absolute truth of it. That's terrible. That's shameful. And that's what causes pain and suffering to the Jewish people. And I might add, to the Messiah himself, even if that would be Yeshu in the Christian concept. So within this context, Lord, I pray that we're successfully, however briefly, discussed Isaiah, and in my opinion, how it properly needs to be understood and applied. And I pray that this should serve as a lesson and a bridge between communities to help bring healing as opposed to continue strife. So on this note, God be willing, let me conclude. Baruch Adonai Leolam. Amen. Amen.